Trilogy Plus One by Dan Perkins, The Brotherhood of the Red Nile.
Dan, you owe me a good night's sleep, and I'm really aggravated about it. I read your books, The Brotherhood of the Red Nile, and I got to tell you, I no longer have to take any no-dos or anything like that when I want to stay awake. I just think about the plots of your books. They are absolutely frightening, devastating, in fact, but some of the best reads I've ever had. And I urge everyone to take a look at it. It's a plausible scenario and one that every American should be absolutely aware of.
Available at Amazon.com.
I'm nervous. Every fish I've taken out of water in the last 2 weeks was almost burning my hand. I don't know how they're surviving, but it was amazing. Anyway, but they're still biting, so I'm still catching them.
Why
I'm going
to
do that.
Yeah.
Today is National Chocolate Cookie Day, and that's my and it deals with gas prices, both domestic and foreign rates. Between last Friday and the opening this morning, wonderful cookie. So I love chocolate, and my daughter-in-law loves chocolate chip cookies, anything else.
Oh, yeah.
So National, I'll have to go tell her, call her when I get off the phone here and tell her today's chocolate chip cookie day. Go get some. So anyway, I was listening to your opening monologue and your gas situation, and in a sense, there's one that particular commentary miss. So interest rates are coming down and gas prices are coming down, which means we're going to see lower gas prices at the pump. It's rare to see that kind of move in both interest rates and commodity prices at the same time of significant magnitude. So the president said he wasn't going to get rid of Powell at the moment. He may wait it out till he's over with. And I think there was a reflex reaction that he's going to stay for at least the remainder of his term. So
which ends, when does his term end?
May of next year, along with our guy from
so he's late, not, the late. So he's not going to lower interest rates until May. Until the new guy gets, Powell it seems to want to create a debt spiral.
Well, what's going on though is that the markets tend to lead the Fed. You know what I mean? Interest rates tend to be in advance of a Fed move, either direction. And what the markets are telling us today, after literally one trading day, that September they're going to be at a 21st point cut in interest rates. The Fed has gotten the message from the markets, and the markets are telling the Fed, you need to come down at least 25 basis points, list cut, and you probably need more cuts through the balance of the year. So the markets generally, as I said, tend to lead the Fed, and the market's saying we're going to see lower rates. We're not going to get 3 points that Donald Trump wants, 3% decline in interest rates, at least not right away. But the markets are anticipating there's going to be at least a 25 basis points cut in interest rates. At the moment, I still think there's a possibility that this is August now, is the annual Jackson Hole bankers meeting. I think that there's a good possibility that Powell will resign after the Jackson Hole meeting. I don't know anything. I didn't talk to anybody I've had some people tell me they feel the same way, but I don't have any inside baseball on this particular story. I just, my instincts tell me that the markets are saying they're going to lower rates, and Powell's effectiveness of the chairman of the Fed is tenuous given the fact that he's done in less than a year. Those two things I thought were significant. The other thing that happened over the weekend, I have been a student of the American Civil War for most of my adult lifetime. In fact, I have a novel that is in the production stages, a new Abraham Lincoln and the Second Assassination. It's a three volume set on Lincoln and what was going on during the Civil War when he was shot. There was a time, if you remember your geography, where Washington, D.C. is. At the time, Virginia was a southern state, and the other part of the capital city was surrounded by the state of Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
Maryland legislature was thinking real seriously about seceding from the Union, which would mean that the capital would have been surrounded by the Confederacy. Lincoln went in and arrested most of the state legislature so they couldn't vote on the secession bill. And some of them skedaddled, left, rather than get caught in that mess. And so they stayed out of the state. And what happened was that as they had abandoned their position, they lost their standing as representatives and were replaced. We had a similar situation happen in Texas over the weekend,
mm-hmm.
where 40 Democrats basically abandoned their jobs at the state and
Cowards.
Went to Illinois because of the redistricting rules that took in place. And actually, if they hold up, Desmond Crockett doesn't have a district anymore. She's gerrymandered out. The governor of Texas saying, look, these people have left. They've shirked their responsibilities. They need to be fired and replaced. And he's going to try and do that. It'll be interesting to see what happens. But again, another example of the Democrats dealing with the problems that they have. There was another situation that came up over the weekend, and that is Schumer to try and exert some control over the process, especially the budget and dealing with a possible closing of the government, was holding up about 100 congressional appointments in exchange for a payment of $1 billion into programs that the Democrats wanted to be funded. And so they're trying to blackmail
Mr.
Trump. Mr. Trump said to Mr. Schumer, hell no. So we've got another confrontation between the Democrats and Republicans.
What's new?
And so far, the Democrats haven't done too well against the president.
No. I think that the governor of Texas should follow through. I mean, these guys are cowards. And they know they're wrong as well.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Those districts in Texas were written on racial lines. And now they're just going mm-hmm. to remove the racism from those racial lines, and the redistricting will benefit the Republicans. It's the way it goes.
Right. Right. And so there's another sort of racial story about voting, in this that the Trump has told Pam, your favorite friend, to go through the states and eliminate all duplicate registration for voters.
Yeah.
And the Democrats are absolutely outraged.
Yeah, because they'll find out. We'll all know how many duplicate voters in blue states and in red states.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of them.
There is a lot of them, and it's going to diminish. Again, it's diminished what the Democrats can do. And when you think about that, let me try and get your opinion on this. We saw polling data last week while you were golfing that the voters have decided that the Democrats have no clue what they're doing and are irresponsible and only received about a 30% approval rating.
Yep.
But which is the lowest in 30 years. But if you go deeper into the polling data and you look at the question, what percentage of responders to this question, what percentage of the responders said strongly approve, meaning they really think that the Democrats are doing a bang-up job? 8%. 8%. Now, you look at that and you say, okay, I got the lowest rating in 30 years, and our strongest supporters are only about 8% of the voters, and they're telling us they're going to turn the Congress and the Senate back to Democratic control. There was CNN last night had a clip with their forecast guy who's not necessarily anti-Democrat or anti-Trump, but pro the facts, was talking about how poorly the Democrats are ranking right now. They nobody can identify her.
Yeah.
If you saw between holes, maybe you saw a clip of Kamala and her interview with the guy who's also going to lose his job in May. But I think that's going to happen sooner. I think he's probably going to get relieved before that if he doesn't tone it down. But the point is that you wonder what these people are smoking or drinking or swallowing that they don't have a common person to talk to. And when Kamala was pressed by Colbert about the leader, well, there isn't really, it's we have a bunch of leaders. I mean, if you saw any of that interview, you'd say, well, it's the old Kamala. She's still there. She hasn't changed. Her promotion of her book was just awful. She hasn't written the book yet, or her ghostwriter hasn't written the book. I mean, somebody said, chapter one is going to be repeated in every chapter. That's going to be one book with one chapter repeated 79 times.
Yeah.
Anyway, I she didn't help herself. Did you actually forget about what she said? Did you physically see her with Colbert?
Just a couple of clips, and it looked typical Kamala, but you know she's not. I understand. She's not going to embarrass herself by running for governor of California.
Right, that's a good idea.
And I don't see how I hope she doesn't embarrass herself by trying to run in 28. I don't think the money that she blew left a real bad taste in a lot of big Democrat donors' mouths. And I don't think I don't think that she's going to get the financial support ever again. Because she can't be trusted with the money.
So I want you and your audience to do me a favor.
Okay.
I don't care whether the sound's on or not.
All right.
Go on Google and look for a clip. And I want you to focus on one image. Look at the relative height in the chair of Kamala to Colbert. She looks like she's sitting in a hole or she's a munchkin. I'm not sure which. It was very, very weird. Like she had shrunk, was talking, but there's a huge difference between her demeanor and Colbert in terms of relative height and presence. And I just looked at that and I played it several times. And I don't know what's going on.
Do you think it was deliberate?
Had a bad chair.
Do you think it was?
Well, I don't know.
Yeah.
You would think that she would want to be at least on the same level as Colbert.
Yeah.
But, the issue that you're raising is a good one, and what the ramifications are of what they're doing. They're making a decision for the moment and don't look at it and say, wait a minute, now that's going to come back and hurt us. We probably shouldn't have said that. But they don't care. They go out and they open and they make all kinds of stupid mistakes, but she shouldn't have done this interview because she didn't endear herself. A lot of people in California, Nancy Pelosi came out immediately and endorsed somebody. There was a caption under a picture of Nancy that in her career in Congress, she's raised over $1 billion for the Democratic Party. I have high hopes, cautiously high hopes, that not only will the Democrats not take over the House or the Senate based on the polling data and what people are happening and what's happening to our economy with the revenue the tariffs are generating, big countries that are capitulating. We had a surplus our budget in the month of June. It's because of the billions of dollars that came in from Biden's or Donald Trump's change in the tariffs. You know, he says we're going to be able to sell rice to China. We're going to sell rice to Japan. we're going to sell American cars in Europe without these outrageous tariffs. So I think it's going to be what's going on. It's going to be a real positive thing for the American economy. And I wouldn't be surprised if we don't see further jobs. And in closing, you saw, I think, where you might have seen where they fired the woman who was in charge of Bureau of Labor Statistics, who generates the job numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And I have said for years that those numbers in the Democratic were driven not by actual counting, but because the Dems needed certain job numbers or unemployment numbers for their political purposes, and she delivered them. And she's apparently gone, and they're now saying that it could be that Biden in his term overstated the number of jobs he created, over a million jobs in his time frame that were not really created. They were just fictitiously counted by this person who was in charge of Bureau of Labor Statistics. And, you know, if you think about it, what a great job if you're a forecaster for the U.S. government. I think the economy is going to grow at 3.4%. And it comes in at 2.7%. Well, they just revise it the next month. Yeah. It's 3.4%.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no accountability for the numbers. And it's crazy how the government has the ability to adjust the numbers to fit their narrative. And the American people buy that, and they just buy that. And when the economists are suggesting that we're going to see a certain level of inflation or whatever, and it doesn't happen, well, I guess we got it wrong.
Yeah.
Well, maybe you didn't get it wrong. Maybe the people playing with the numbers played with the numbers.
Exactly.
So, but I do think that the president's doing a phenomenal job. The Epstein thing, it's crazy, and people don't seem to understand that. No matter, Schumer doesn't understand, or he understands and refuses to accept it. As it relates to releasing all the documents, there's no way that the president, no matter how powerful he or she would be, can force a judge to release the transcript of testimony before a grand jury.
Yeah.
It's just never done. And because there's too much danger to people that would be testifying. But I just don't see whether this, then I don't see the court. He sent an assistant attorney general to go talk with the judge, and the judge said, absolutely not. I'm not going to release it. Now, I think there's a possibility, you know, as the great leaks occur in Washington, D.C., we're going to see leaks eventually of what some of that grand jury testimony, but I don't think there's anything there.
Yeah.
And as I've said many, many, many times, Joe Biden was the one responsible for prosecuting and sentencing him and doing the investigation. And if he had anything, Epstein had anything dealing with Donald Trump, the Democrats would have used it within seconds after it was discovered.
Oh, yeah.
And there hasn't been anything, and they haven't claimed any. So that means that tells me that there seems to be no evidence that Donald Trump was part of the Epstein Lolita.
I'm sorry. I didn't know we were still talking about this. I mean, I actually look, you know,
I think I said on your show before you left, I said, look, here's the reality. Should we be spending time on Epstein, or should we spend time trying to figure out how to get the Russians to the table to end this damn war in Ukraine?
Yeah.
There's no comparison between the two.
No.
I mean, it's a waste of time.
We got bigger fish to fry, quite frankly. And all that stuff is going to come out in the wash. And I suggest it hurts the Clintons more than it hurts any Republican. And as you said, and I agree wholeheartedly, if they had anything on Trump from the Epstein's files, they would have buried him with it. That would have been the reason for Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah, I talked to two attorneys last week in interviews for my show, and both of them said, Hillary Clinton's in serious trouble.
Oh, yeah.
Serious trouble over what's going on. She could go to jail. God, would I like to see that.
At least the perp walk.
Yes.
You know?
So, anyway. Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
And we'll keep trying to do a good show for you.
Well, I think you do. It's Dan Perkins, ladies and gentlemen. Check out his website, danperkinsmedia.org, danperkinsmedia.org. Have a great week, my friend, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you, sir. Take care. Bye.
I know a lot of you are already on my side. And for you naysayers, I have two strong words for you. Come on. Come on!
Sure. All right. We'll be right back with Charlotte County Speaks on News Radio 1580 WCCF.
Don't doubt me. We told you the jobs numbers was one big fat fugazi. Does it make any difference whether it's a donkey in the White House or an elephant in the White House? They just lie when it comes to jobs numbers. You're talking about bad. The revisions haven't been this bad since 1979, and it was as plain as day. People, at some point in time, you got to grab the bull by the horns, and you've got to be your own economist. You got to see the forest for the trees. It's like these people, they're weathermen, and there's, it's sunny outside, and you go outside, and it's pouring all over your head, and yet you still believe them. Don't do that. Okay, the economy, without a doubt, has weakened. The tariffs, without a doubt, is killing jobs. And without a doubt, your prices are going up. Period. The end. WatchdogOnWallStreet.com.
Such negative waves, man. Real burnout. News Radio 1580 100.9 FM WCCF 1041 here, Charlotte County Speaks. Phone lines open at 941-206-1580. What do you think of J.D. Vance? Kind of like it, huh? Some of his friends, not too thrilled with, but outside of that, I think he's doing a pretty good job. And he's right about the Democrats just being completely unable to pivot, change course, change direction, look themselves in the mirror, do a little self-reflection, and come up with some policies that actually benefit the American people instead of just Trump. And the whole Sidney Sweeney thing just kind of brought it all together. Here he is.
Yeah, my political advice to the Democrats is continue to tell everybody who thinks Sidney Sweeney is attractive is a Nazi. that appears to be their actual strategy. I mean, it actually reveals something pretty interesting about the Dems, though, mm-hmm. which is that you have like a normal all-American beautiful girl doing like a normal jeans ad, right? They're trying to sell jeans to kids in America, and they have managed to so unhinge themselves over this thing. And it's like, you guys, did you learn nothing from the November 2024 election? Like, I actually thought that one of the lessons they might take is we're going to be less crazy. Yeah. The lesson they have apparently taken is we're going to attack people as Nazis for thinking Sidney Sweeney is beautiful. Great strategy, guys. That's how you're going to win the midterm, especially young American men.
Their course correction lasted about 30 seconds.
That's right. Lasted 30 seconds. Somehow has gotten even crazier. But again, it's just so much of the Democrats is oriented around hostility to mm-hmm. basic American life.
Yeah, that's true. J.D. Vance. Speaking of hostile Democrats. CIA Director John Ratcliffe and FBI Director Kash Patel are set to release more damning documents proving the FBI covered up Clinton's collusion hoax while amplifying the Steele dossier. They were all complicit in it. We kind of all know that. The more they release, the more we keep asking what the hell's going to happen, other than maybe some low-hanging fruit and maybe Brennan, maybe Comey. If you're lucky, I don't think you're going to see anything happen to anybody else at all. Sorry, but I'd be ecstatic to say I was wrong in this regard, but I don't even think that they're going to go after the Kenyan Q-tip at all for this. They're going to out him as much as they can, but when it comes down to actual accountability, legal accountability, I'm sorry, it's not going to happen. All right, kids. I think that's all we have time for today. Tomorrow will be better. Yeah. I'll be back tomorrow.
We're News Radio 1580 AM WCCF Punta Gorda and FM 100.9 W265 EA Punta Gorda.
Dan Perkins Media presents a unique and exciting program. Truth Starts Now, a conversation with Dan Perkins. The left has taken away your rights to freedom of speech. Truth Starts Now is a platform for you to regain your voice. America and Americans will be better off if we can have civil and respectful conversations about the day's important issues. Now, here's your host, Dan Perkins.
To the Truth Starts Now. Joining us today is Keith Gross, and he's from Florida, my home state at the moment. And we're going to talk about some very interesting things. Welcome to the program, sir.
Thanks for having me on, Dan.
We had a great conversation before we joined you this afternoon, and we're going to talk about two things. We're going to talk about what's going on with Tulsi and the three musketeers, as I call them, who are trying to change what they said before Congress and other things. And it's going to be an interesting thing. And then we're going to talk in the second segment, we're going to talk about presidential pardons. So Keith, we have all this stuff that the Tulsi brought it forward. And, you know, one of the questions, if I had the chance to ask her a question about all these documents that she's already delivered and that there's more, where were they? How did the Biden administration hide them for 4 years? It would be interesting to hear what she has to say. So we're talking about the action where in December the 6th, President Barack Obama was being briefed on a presidential national security, and he was being briefed over on what was going on with Donald Trump and the Russiagate situation. And he didn't like the documents because the documents, which were collected by the various intelligence agencies, and they made an opinion to the president. There's no evidence here that Donald Trump was an agent of the Russian government, or he was in cahoots, or that the Russian government tried to do anything as it relates to the presidential election. And so my question to you is, if Barack Obama operated in this area while he was president, when he left on January 20th and Donald Trump became president, he was a private citizen. He didn't have immunity. And you're telling me that in certain activities, if you look at the court ruling, there are areas where he does not have immunity. And this activity to try and change a government or duly elected official might be one of those areas where he doesn't have any protection.
It could be. You know, we've got a lot of information that hopefully will be released to us, and we can have a public review of some of these facts, because right now we don't have enough facts to know. There's the concept of presidential immunity, and that applies to everything a president does while acting in the scope of the presidency as commander-in-chief, as the chief executive of the nation. But there are certain things that a sitting president even could do which would fall outside of presidential immunity because they are not related to his conduct in an official capacity. And so there are going to be questions raised, no doubt, as some of this information comes out about not only some of the things that he did while he was still in office that may have gone outside of the realm of official acts of the president, but certainly, as you pointed out, after he left office, what involvement did he have when he was a private citizen that might constitute criminal behavior with his efforts to undermine the incoming administration?
Let me try this question on you. If he has, as president of the United States, you pointed out he is the commander-in-chief of the of all military. But I think I'm right on this, and I don't believe there's any law, but a matter of precedent and tradition. The sitting president is generally conceived to be the leader of the party in power. In other words, Barack Obama, when he was president of the United States, was de facto the leader of the Democratic Party. And until there's a new Democratic candidate after he leaves office, he has a great deal of power and influence as the retiring president, even until we get to the next election. So while he doesn't have any legal authority in the government after he leaves office, he has a lot of political influence.
I think that's pretty undisputed. Most people would consider a sitting president to be the head of their party, whether officially or unofficially. The question regarding Obama is whether or not he unlawfully weaponized U.S. government assets and intelligence agencies to act in a political capacity. And, you know, the facts that are going to be released, hopefully, in the near future will illustrate enough for us to have a better view in that. Right now, all we know is what Tulsi has shared so far, which is some pretty bombshell allegations that, as you pointed out, not only was there no evidence that Russia was working to elect Donald Trump, there actually was evidence suggesting that Russia assumed there would be a Hillary Clinton presidency, and they were looking forward to that because they had plenty of dirt on her that they were going to keep secret until after she won in hopes of negotiating more aggressively with the United States.
Frank Krankweiser memo.
Right.
So I'm not trying to be redundant. This is such new information. I just want to make sure that our audience understands it. So again, if I'm wrong, you correct me. I have no shame in being corrected if I'm wrong. I understood you to say, and these are my words, that a person who's sitting in the Oval Office really has two situations. There is the commander-in-chief, the chief executive of the operating government, where he is responsible for making decisions and doing things regarding to the running of the government, the military, war, whatever it is. Sitting in the same chair behind the resolute desk, he is also a politician and a party leader. And when he acts for the benefit of the party, he's not acting as president. That's where he has potential culpability. Did I get that correct?
Sure, that's definitely a potential area of culpability, though I'll tell you, it's possible that you can act in the benefit of your party and also simultaneously in the benefit of the people. So the real question isn't who benefits, it's was the act conducted by that sitting president something that falls within the official duties of a sitting president? It doesn't really matter whether or not it helped his party. It matters whether or not it's something he had the authority to do as president. So if he's going to put on his chief law enforcement of the country hat, and he wanted to have our intelligence agencies look into someone with valid suspicions and then accurately report those findings, that would be within the scope of the president. If he instead said, oh, I see the facts, intelligence agencies, but those don't fit my party's narrative, go rewrite them here, do it this way, that might fall outside the scope of the presidency. It'll be a very fact-based determination that ultimately the DOJ will be digging into now that Tulsi started sharing some of this information.
If Barack Obama did not like the submission that says there was no collusion, no influencing, none of that stuff was there. The fact that he did not like it and ordered a different interpretation, how could he perceive to be working as president and not as a party leader?
If the facts support that, he probably wouldn't be found to be acting in his official capacity. You know, the idea of official capacity and immunity based on official acts is largely a court-derived immunity doctrine. the court's going to have to make some decisions here on what is and isn't within the scope of immunity. You know, just on a hypothetical basis, everyday Americans, we can think about situations where, you know, if the president makes a decision to fire a missile on an enemy camp, that's definitely within the power of the presidency. But if he orders dinner from the pizzeria down the street and then says he's not going to pay the bill, well, they can sue him because that definitely was not an official act. You know, that's him acting as an individual. A president is simultaneously a citizen and the chief executive. The question is, which hat is he wearing when he does a given thing? It's going to take a lot of facts to dig into how he manipulated the intelligence services to support his political party's political needs.
So the Justice Department is empowering a, what would be the right word, an investigative team to look into the documents, the allegations, and see whether Strike Force, I think it's called.
Right.
What would be the protocol? Would this, they would gather the information and try and bring it to a conclusion, which they bring to the Attorney General. Does she then go to a court and have a grand jury, or do they have a charge for against the people involved, and then there's a trial, or what would be the procedure, and is it likely to have to happen in Washington, D.C.?
So the typical procedure here is that the investigation would be conducted. Department of Justice would interview witnesses, review documents, communications, and gather every scrap of evidence they possibly can. Like you said, then it would be presented likely to the Attorney General herself, who would make a charging decision. Once a charging decision was made, there would be a grand jury impaneled. It would be done in secret. The public wouldn't hear anything about it happening until the findings were rendered and an indictment was made or not made. At that point, let's assume an indictment's made, because grand juries are pretty one-sided operations. Usually, if one will be impaneled, an indictment will follow. So let's say there was an indictment. Then there would be a criminal charge in court, and you know those charged could be arrested. It could be a relatively informal arrest and booking, much like was done with President Trump when he was arrested. Or it could be a pretty typical kick in the door at 6 a.m., raid your house sort of arrest. In any case, it would be incumbent upon the former president to assert in court that no, I'm immune from this because of presidential immunity. And a court would then make findings, it would be appealed. Eventually the Supreme Court would make a decision. But supposed immunity doesn't prevent the charges from being brought in court. They operate as a defense after the charges are brought.
From a political standpoint, if we get more and more evidence that shows that there was wrongdoing, a lot of people who've made a lot of money off of this deal are going to be finding themselves in a very embarrassing position, if not in jail.
I would think so. To the extent there was malfeasance, I bet it went a lot further than just the president. There were a lot of people involved in this grand conspiracy, and it's pretty clear there was a great effort to cover it up. You saw the efforts to declassify Crossfire Hurricane documents at the end of President Trump's first term. We saw President Trump's home at Mar-a-Lago raided, and many of us believe it was an attempt by the Biden administration, probably at the behest of the Obama team, to recover any of those Crossfire Hurricane documents that President Trump declassified on his way out and possibly took with him. I think there was a large conspiracy, a grand cover-up, and I'm curious to see where the investigation leads.
What's your gut tell you?
I think there will be some people going to jail. It's unlikely really? That it will be the former president, I think. At the very least, ultimately, the immunity question may go against him, but there wasn't adequate notice that these acts were not immune. Therefore, the next guy, now you're on notice, but the last guy, it wasn't fair to you because you weren't on notice. That's the usual way that people sidestep accountability with immunity doctrines, and I wouldn't be surprised if it happens again.
We're going to take a break, but before we go, Keith, tell our listeners and viewers how they can follow you and what you do.
Well, I am an attorney based in Panama City, Florida. I'm a conservative activist, and you can find me at keithgross.com, or you can follow me on any social platform at keithgrossfl.
Super. We'll be right back after these messages.
Perkins, the author of Sad Eyes, Book 2. In Book 1, we watch her grow up and develop into an intelligent, practical, and beautiful woman. She knows what she wants to be, and she will not let anything happen that will stop her from reaching her goal. Book 2 has many challenges she faces during World War II, People say it's hard to put down. You can get Sad Eyes Book 2 at Amazon.com or JanCarrollPublishing.com and ask at Jan Carroll for a special deal if you buy both books.
Welcome back. We're talking to Keith Gross, and we're now going to talk about presidential pardons. There seems to be a lot of discussion as to whether or not President Biden has acted in the way in which the pardon rules are and what he's supposed to be doing, and has he delegated responsibility for pardons to staff people who are not elected, and when the Constitution says that he has to make the decision. So what's your take on what's going on with the pardon situation?
One of the really interesting things about so much that we see lately is how, despite our nation being active for over 250 years, we still have so many areas of our Constitution where the law is unclear, where there's no precedent. The use of the auto pen by Biden is one of those occasions where I think most legal scholars would agree that the use of the auto pen itself is acceptable. The question is whether or not the president issued authorization for the use of the auto pen for a specific purpose. As you pointed out, the power of the pardon rests solely with the president himself. It comes directly from the Constitution, which gives the president broad authority on how he will exercise that plenary constitutional power. In this case, with Joe Biden, we have him in a Fox interview saying that he didn't even know the names of some of the people that were pardoned, which brings a valid question to light on whether or not he exercised his authority and decision-making ability when issuing those pardons. Was there some staff member running wild, just pressing a button on a machine, signing pardons? Or did Joe Biden actually pardon these people? That's the question.
Well, we had a former chief of staff indicating that the chief of staff, not Biden, had ordered the pardon to be drawn and signed on the auto pen and didn't go to the president. In fact, there was another staffer who was doing a lot of the auto pen pardons, said she never got an order from the White House through the president or any representative of the president saying that they were speaking for the president. She was just told to issue these pardons. So again, it appears that there were people in the White House who were taking over the responsibility of certain portions of the government that the president was supposed to be doing but wasn't either capable or couldn't do. One of those areas is pardons. And the idea that you can delegate the ability to approve a pardon, the founding fathers, when they wrote the Constitution and put in the pardoning powers, made only one person. The president of the United States is the only one who can make the decision and grant or deny the pardon. And yet, I understand the auto pen becomes the scapegoat, but more importantly, as I think we need to figure out, who was the one that was ordering the pardons to be drawn up and signed with the auto pen? And I think the former is more important than the latter. And do we have people, unelected officials, who were dealing with the pardons and were giving the pardons without the president's consent? And as you said, he didn't even know. Leads me to another question. I didn't ask this, so I'm going to ask this now, and I'm not asking it to put you on the spot. I apologize for not asking it before. Does your firm represent people who are looking for presidential pardons?
We haven't represented anyone looking for a presidential pardon, but you know, I think anytime you have a person that you're working with as a lawyer, if they're convicted of a federal crime, why wouldn't you ask for a pardon? The worst you can get is no, right? Generally, the process, and it doesn't have to be this way, but the general process is that you have the Office of the Pardon Attorney, who ultimately is part of the executive branch, reports to the president. The Office of the Pardon Attorney typically reviews those applications and makes suggestions to the president saying, here's a list of people that we think you might want to pardon. I would suppose that this differs by administration, but generally the Office of the Pardon Attorney is going to make recommendations to the president based on the president's own priorities. And so if you have a president saying, find me people who, you know, were convicted of the following crimes, I want to prioritize pardoning them, then the Office of the Pardon Attorney would submit lists based on that guidance. But the thing is, and that's what's so interesting about the constitutional authority granted to the president, only the president gets to decide how to use it, when it's plenary power that comes straight from the Constitution, under our theory of government, it's beyond review. As long as the president is acting clearly within the bounds of that constitutional authority, not even the Supreme Court can have some opinion on how he exercises it. Now, there are foundational principles of law like consent, knowledge, mental capacity. These concepts would apply to a president's actions, even under a plenary constitutional authority like the pardon power. But there's nothing in our Constitution or precedent in law here that says a president's only allowed to pardon a given number of people or that he has to do it in a certain form. There's not even a requirement necessarily that it be on a piece of paper. You know, if the president says you are hereby pardoned, there's nothing that says he has to write that down or sign it. I mean, if I were getting a pardon, I'd sure as heck want it in writing so no one changes their mind or argues about it. But, you know, there's nothing that says it has to be signed and it has to have a cool little certificate that comes with it. I would separate the concept of issuing the pardon. That's something that the president does simply by him deciding to and saying so. I would separate that decision from the issuance of the pardon certificate. And so, in theory, a president could pardon someone and then direct his staff to issue certificates in accordance with his action. But first, a president would have to know that he was issuing a pardon. And it sounds like Joe Biden may not have even known that he was supposedly issuing pardons, because he said he didn't know the contents of these things. He didn't know the names. And I think anybody that saw the man on TV during his term would say, I don't think he knew his own name half the time, much less what he was doing in his official capacity.
Again, I'm not trying to put you on the spot. We only had so much time to talk before we went on the air. I want to raise an issue for you. Now, I can say that I've read extensively on this whole situation. I have not seen anybody yet raise the question I'm about to raise with you. When I spoke to the pardon office in Washington, D.C., they referred me to the website of the pardon attorney as to what is a typical fee that can be charged for a pardon request. What I was told was that in many cases, and that's why I asked if your firm had done any, in many cases, you have a lead attorney who may or may not, depending upon the complexity of the case, may seek other outside professional help in preparing his case to file for the pardon. And in the case of where it's another attorney that's being involved, both attorneys are under privilege. Now, my understanding is that if I were to hire your firm to get me a pardon, and the operative is to try and get me one, not that you can get me one, but to try, you may want to charge me, let's say, $100,000 for that pardon. When you go to another attorney to do other work, privilege is extended. So I give you the check for $100,000. You don't have to tell any authority where the money went and who did what because of privilege.
Generally speaking, that would be accurate. It's no one's business what the fee was or how you spent it.
If we, in fact, had 8,500 pardons and we had, I picked a number of $50,000 per pardon, and there were 15,000 pardon requests, at least 15,000 through the pardon office. And if the average was $25,000 to $50,000, with no guarantee, the amount of money on the table could be billions of dollars.
Well, you know, I had never seen that figure of $100,000 for a pardon, and I must be in the wrong line of business, Dan, because if I could get a $100,000 flat rate, I'd fill out a lot of pardon applications. But I think the reality is, joking aside, that sounds like a very large, very high flat rate fee for, you know, I'm sure a very important and time-consuming operation, but It almost sounds predatory to charge someone $100,000 to process a pardon application, particularly with the knowledge that no matter how good of a lawyer you are, there's no guarantee, there's not even any likelihood that that pardon will be granted. That's purely An operation of presidential discretion, and there's no proper way to influence that presidential discretion. So I can't imagine someone paying $100,000 to fill that application out. You know, I've never handled one here at our firm, but we usually handle things on an hourly basis. You know, even at our highest attorney's billing rate, which is just under $1,000 an hour, I can't imagine it taking that many hours to fill one of these things out.
Well, I have done research on the internet, and I have actually found fees for pardons on prominent people over $1 million.
Well, I need to get in a different line of business. That sounds okay. Great.
But there aren't necessarily that many people. But my point is, if you typically give 100 or 200, 300 pardons in a four-year term as president at $25,000, $50,000, $100,000, it's not much money. But if you're talking 15,000 pardon requests at $25,000 to $50,000 or maybe more, all of a sudden the magnitude of the money involved is significant. And I'm wondering whether or not if I give a pardon to all of inmates on death row in federal penitentiaries, regardless of their crime, I give them pardons, flat pardons for commutation of their sentence, somebody got some money.
And sure. I mean, private attorneys, sure, would make money, but that doesn't really change the validity of the president's exercise of the pardon power. I mean, what's to stop a president from pardoning literally every person currently in prison for conviction of any federal crime? I don't think there's any constitutional limitation on the exercise of that power.
What I'm wondering is whether or not there's a possibility, was there pay for play? Was there money that somehow made its way back to the Biden family for pardoning?
Well, I sure hope not, though I don't think people were buying Hunter Biden's art due to his artistic talent. So there's certainly some questions that no doubt the current Department of Justice will be analyzing with respect to the Biden administration and the Obama administration. I mean, this is American accountability at its finest. You're not going to be in power forever, no matter how great you are, how popular you are. Another Department of Justice will be impaneled when you're out of office, and they're going to investigate everything you did. So, you know, hopefully the accountability that follows will prohibit people from being bold enough to take these actions in the future.
Do you think, and we've got 1 minute left, do you think, I'm not asking you to go back on what you just said, but what role does the deep state have or had in manipulating many, many things to their advantage and to the certain politicians' advantage that were illegal, the distrust in the government in general?
You know, no doubt since the founding of our nation, there have been unelected bureaucrats wielding power and pushing things towards whatever outcome they wanted. And as our government has grown, especially in the last handful of decades, we've seen entrenched people, the deep state, as we call them now, and they are certainly wielding a lot of power. They affect how government operates, and we saw how they could ignore the president's wishes when President Trump was in term last time. Even now, he'll issue an executive order, and these bureaucrats slow walk that order instead of do what the president wants. That sort of thing will change when the president takes control of his branch and fires those responsible.
Well, we're out of time. I would love to have you come back on as a regular. I enjoyed the conversation with you. And tell us how we can get in touch with you again.
Give me a follow on any of the social platforms at Keith Gross FL. You can also sign up for the newsletter at keithgross.com.
Thank you, sir. Pleasure to be
Thanks
with you.
Thanks so much.
We'll be right back with him after this break.
All right.
A Trilogy Plus One by Dan Perkins, The Brotherhood of the Red Nile.
Dan, you owe me a good night's sleep, and I'm really aggravated about it. I read your books, The Brotherhood of the Red Nile. And I got to tell you, I no longer have to take any no-dos or anything like that when I want to stay awake. I just think about the plots of your books. They are absolutely frightening, devastating, in fact, but some of the best reads I've ever had. And I urge everyone to take a look at it. It's a plausible scenario and one that every American should be absolutely aware of.
Available at Amazon.com.
Thanks for listening to the show today. We hope you enjoyed it. And if you'd like to send a comment, please do so by sending it to dan@danperkinsmedia.org. And thanks for listening to the show today.